Dr. David Pritchard is a scientist at MIT in Cambridge and co-chair of the Abduction Study Conference held at MIT. He joins us from WBUR in Boston. Welcome to the program.
How do you do, Ira?
How are you? C.D.D. Bryan is a journalist in Guilford, Connecticut, and author of Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, Alien Abduction, UFOs, and the Conference at MIT, published by Knopf. And he's here with me in the studio this afternoon. Welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, and hello, Dave.
Hi, Courtney. Also, John Carpenter is with us. John Carpenter is a hypnotherapist and licensed clinical social worker in Springfield, Missouri, and he joins us by phone from his office. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon to you. Let me begin by asking you, David Pritchard, why did you help organize this conference with John Mack?
Probably it was even more my idea than his, but basically I had gotten interested in this phenomenon, namely the people making these crazy, bizarre, I guess would be a better word, reports. And I became aware of a lot of the research that had been done, much of it not published, about this phenomenon. And I decided to run a conference in which people could come and report their research, and then other people could discuss it, criticize it, ask questions about it. And that's a scientific conference. And so that's what we did.
And so people came and read scientific papers and made presentations.
Yes. Actually, we had 100 presentations. Several people made a couple of presentations because we had a very careful overview of the phenomenon that was established by the committee of sort of experts in this area. And then the people put their various presentations on this outline so the whole thing would be coherent. Because one of the things we were really trying to do was to make a comprehensible overview of this, the proceedings, which is actually published now. It's a book called Alien Discussion. And to make that kind of a working collection of the research in this field.
Now, you're a world-class, tenured, well-respected scientist. People know you around the world. You must have received a lot of heat for deciding to do this. Or laughing or skepticism or something. What drove you to decide as a scientist that you would like to help sponsor this?
Well, you know, really, it's what we call, curiosity-driven or basic research. I mean, I just thought this was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll tell you some of the reasons that I think that I'm maybe predisposed to think that. First of all, I think it's clear that the existence of other intelligent life in the universe is a dynamic scientific issue. I mean, if we could discover that kind of life, it would be Copernicus Revolutions Part 2, and I guess if they were here, Part 3.
Right. And in fact, we as a culture believe there is other life, and scientists have set up search for extraterrestrial life out there.
Exactly. But the majority of scientists feel, and this view was presented at the conference by Paul Horowitz, who's one of the leaders of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence using radio. They think it's going to be too expensive to come here, for the aliens to come here. But I hold with the minority of scientific community that advanced highly technical extraterrestrial civilizations could indeed send unmanned, maybe call them unaliens, probes here. And in fact, there's been a conference recently, last fall, at NYU. I didn't have anything to do with it. But that was for people who wanted to get together and figure out how humans could send probes to the nearest star system to explore any planets that were there. So I think it's just a matter of time, maybe 1,000 years, maybe 100,000 years, but technology is rolling on, and it's going to get easier and cheaper to send some sort of small, intelligent thing to elsewhere in the universe.
Mm-hmm. Now, Courtney Bryan, you're not a UFO writer. You're a very well-known writer, but you've never written about UFOs.
Not until now. No.
Well, what got you interested in this?
I think probably very much what got Dave Pritchard interested in it. To me, the idea that serious people like Dave Pritchard and John Mack with serious credentials, we're holding a serious conference at a serious scientific institution on a subject which I thought was similar to Mickey Mouse, was new. So I went up there as a commissioned by the New Yorker to cover the conference, and I found it as fascinating as all of us have, that you do get sucked into it. It's an intriguing subject, and one of the great mysteries.
Did you find your beliefs changing about the issue back and forth or as you were up there?
I think it's like quicksand. The more time I spent at the conference, the more vulnerable I was, and I found that my skepticism was shifting. Mm. so that I was getting less and less skeptical about the phenomenon and becoming more and more skeptical about my previous closed mind.
In fact, reading your book and reading also reading the proceedings that David Pritchard has published, really, I describe it as very disturbing. It's one of the most disturbing books I have ever read. I've read a lot of science books and a lot of philosophy, and you come away because it really clicks with what the evidence itself. Hearing people say and hearing the book talk about that these are not crazy people for the most part, that they have passed psychological tests, that they are not nuts. Talk with the utmost sincerity about what has happened to them really challenges your thoughts about what the truth is.
Well, I think as John Mack had said when I interviewed him, he said that the most single powerful thing for him was that here were people, otherwise quite ordinary, unremarkable, reporting with full sincerity and in the most authentic way these extraordinary experiences, which they didn't want to believe were true. So really it was the abductees as much as the scientists who were convincing to me.
John Carpenter, as a clinical social worker and a hypnotherapist, you have, I understand it, talked to 100 or more people claiming to be abducted. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Probably I've talked to 200 and worked with about 130 with clinical hypnosis.
And do you give them a battery of psychological tests to make sure that they have their head on straight?
Well, I have several screening tools, and if I feel like I need to do some psychological testing, I will, but as everyone has stated thus far, these people come across quite normal and credible, and basically they're as confused as we are about what's going on, what's happening to them.
So then they come for help, not because they like the experience of communing with aliens and want to do it again, but because they don't like it.
Well, I've never had anyone yet who wanted this experience. They may adapt and grow to, I guess, accept it over time, but certainly in the beginning, nobody comes wanting it or desiring it.
And according to the books and the proceedings, it appears that these people want to be told that they're nuts, because if they're told they're crazy, there's no magic pill that they could be given, they could be put away, they'll be cured, and they won't come back having these same feelings again.
But, well, exactly.
They're told just the opposite, that they're not crazy.
Yes, and that does bother them to some extent, because crazy is more acceptable at this point.
So then what do you do for these people?
Well, what we try to do is, first of all, because these experiences have been, in essence, locked inside of them, either suppressed, repressed, or hypnotically suggested to not be remembered, as they recall them, it's as if they're recalling something that has been forgotten or a part of them all along. This, as with any repressed material, feels better as it comes up and they're able to reintegrate it back into their lives. Now, the problem is it's such a wild thing to become aware of that does leave them in need of support. We immediately put them in touch with others who've had the experience, not to share intricate details, but to just offer support and understanding. And eventually then they usually grow and change and develop what we all have come to know as a broader view of our own universe. As C.D. Brian said, you know, it's something that just opens your mind up, and then you begin to question your former way of looking at things.
One of the most fascinating parts about the tales being told by the abductees is that they are so similar. And they describe, I remember reading in your book, saying that, well, one of the great criticisms of the research here is that this could all be coincidental and that there are so many people who could be just randomly talking about the same kind of event, but it doesn't appear to happen that way, does it? They all talk about same looking alien, same type of experience of abduction, same kind of spaceship.
Yet same scenario, same sequence of events, the same tables, the same interior.
Now, as John Carpenter, why cannot this be coincidence? I mean, why isn't it just something, you know, if you have a couple of hundred million people in a population, that maybe a few thousand of them are going to have this sort of similar type of experience?
Well, there's there's too many reasons to go into on the air here. It would take another hour just to talk about imagination, fantasy, and expectation. But in general, imagination doesn't work this way. We had a classroom of 30 children draw an alien. None of them drew anything alike, and none of them even drew a little gray creature. Instead, they came up with what you would expect, 30 wonderfully creative, imaginative drawings.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pritchard, of course, what the mainstream scientific community will say with good reason is, if we're being visited by aliens, where is the hard physical evidence for it? And how do you answer that?
Well, I have to say that I've looked and I haven't found any. I've looked in, I've kind of talked to the investigators and said, you know, when you get a really solid looking piece of physical evidence, I might be interested in investigating it. And I spent a great deal of effort investigating an artifact that an experiencer alleged was an implant. And if you read the standard scenario, you'll find that implants are often put in the head or in the genitals. This one was in the latter place. And so he had what I considered an artifact with an excellent pedigree. Namely, he had evidence that he'd been talking about being abducted by aliens even before the Betty and Barney Hill case was published. He had an 8-year-old note from a doctor that he'd examined this thing underneath his skin and said, well, leave it there, but it sort of told how big it was. He had a description of seeing a conscious, not hypnotically recovered, very, very powerful memory of the scenario under which this was implanted in him, and he had a description of the artifact before it was put in him. So when he finally sort of dislodged it from his skin and brought it to me, and it conformed, it had the little wires that he talked about, it had what I call appendages, I took it on and analyzed it carefully. And the result of all that analysis was that it is human damage tissue, you know, white cells and other things that flood to a site where maybe you get an ingrown hair or some insult to the skin. And in addition to that, it had captured a lot of clear cotton fibers, which, of course, could have come from his underwear. So I came up with what's likely a very prosaic explanation for this artifact. And similarly, when I took some alleged MRIs of head implants and a couple that were presented at the conference to a local radiologist for a second opinion, he said, well, you know, this one and that one are artifacts of the process. This is one of the confusions. These people will sometimes be told by the doctor, well, that's an artifact, and they think, oh, that's an alien artifact. And the doctor means, well, you know, in MRI, you don't get a picture. You reconstruct it from some sort of frequency domain scan, and there can be artifacts of that reconstruction process. And so that's one of them. Or he would point out that another one, well, yes, there is something there, but that looks like the scarring you get in the nasal passages due to just breathing too much dry air in winter. So there was no alien artifact, no smoking gun. And in my experience, all of the claimed physical artifact that I have examined or that I've heard examined carefully, there has been either no explanation that it's anything unusual or even in the case of the Richard Price alleged implant, a more prosaic explanation. I will say there is a tiny bit of evidence, and John Carpenter was involved in that, of people who had diseases or medical conditions that cleared up mysteriously and that they attributed to alien healing. But there's no hard physical evidence, absolutely not.
Do you argue then that this whole thing is a bunch of nonsense?
No, I don't argue that. What I argue is, you're just going, if you think of the whole problem, you're going to be able to catch aliens that are clumsy, that leave around obvious, you know, pieces of string, of alien string or alien machinery. And if you do a certain level of investigation, you're only going to find ones that are clumsier than a certain amount. And we've gone to a certain level. I haven't invested very much time because I can't do this with my regular money or time. I do this in my spare time. And I've done a quick scan and I haven't found anything. But doesn't say if you did a more careful examination, you wouldn't find something there.
And there was, I think, Horowitz. at the conference, he said the evidence, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Right.
Yeah. But you're never going to get anybody to spend any real money, any kinds of money on actually trying to find any hard evidence here.
You're not getting some private people. You're not going to be able to convince NSF to do it. That's for sure.
Let me say something, Ira. With my book that has just come out, I've gone around the country talking about the subject, and what has amazed me is how open people are all the way across. I mean, from Toronto, if I can consider Toronto part of our country for the moment, as far as, Seattle, San Francisco, East Boston, things like that. All over the country, people believe something is going on. Scripps Howard did a poll 2 weeks ago, a month ago, saying 50% of the people in this country believe in UFOs, believe that there's a government conspiracy. Over and over again, when I was interviewed, the people interviewing me were far less skeptical about this phenomenon than I am. And I don't know why there isn't the kind of necessary funds to program, really, a scientific investigation.
You point out yourself in the book that Jimmy Carter, before he was elected, said that he had seen a UFO and was going to do something about it as he became president, looking into it, and then, voila, once he was president,
it disappeared in the National Security Agency.
Just disappeared.
Yeah.
So even the president himself can't get anything going on here. John Carpenter, do you have any estimate of how many people nationally, internationally claim to be abducted?
Well,
how widespread is this phenomenon?
It's easy for me to say thousands because we already have several thousand cases documented. I could easily project that it's millions because there's so many people who have mentioned they've had contact or stories that haven't officially been researched. And yet they come across in the same genuine fashion. I think you have to remember it's a reporting phenomenon as well. Who feels comfortable reporting? What country allows such discussion? Russia didn't for the longest time. Now that it's more open, we're getting many more reports out of there, which have just been sat on, essentially, for years.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Daniel in San Antonio. Hi, Daniel.
Good afternoon. I was a serious UFO investigators in the 70s and 80s. I worked with Dr. William K. Hartman in analyzing the photographs for the Colorado study for the Air Force. I worked with Dr. James McDonald at the University of Arizona on his studies of radar, analysis of naval cases, and so on. And I was the first, as far as I know, only PhD-level full-time researcher hired to do UFO research as my profession in the mid-70s. My experience is that what we're dealing with here is a spiritual encounter, not an alien encounter, because there's a spiritual component to every one of these encounters. That is, the person always comes away with a message of some kind, an alteration of their worldview, and their alteration of the worldview is an anti-biblical viewpoint, and it's always the same. Very parallel to, as Mrs. Coral Lorenzen used to say, it's an occult phenomenon.
But isn't the actual abduction scenario itself very biblical? The fiery chariot coming out of the sky, the fire from the sky, the bright light, that sort of thing.
Well, our enemy Satan endeavors to do a spiritual encounter, he always tries to replicate the things of God.
Let me get a reply from John Carpenter.
Well, first of all, in my 130 cases, they don't all come away with a spiritual message. In fact, what I've found is a wide range of reactions. Some feel victimized, some feel negative, some do have a spiritual reaction, but it's not a case of always. And certainly, out of 130 cases, I probably have about 5 or 6 that have any kind of a detailed spiritual feeling. And also, I'd just like to throw in that cases like Roswell and other documented crashes of UFOs where you have bodies and nuts and bolts type stuff kind of makes me suspect that, sure, it can have a spiritual component, but it's kind of difficult to think it's entirely spiritual.
All right, Daniel, thanks for calling. In fact, the Roswell autopsy pictures have been making the rounds, and I was reading on an internet page, a UFO internet page, which claimed to be, I take no sides on it, by a ufologist who said that those autopsies have done more to set back. They're so bad, they're so phony, so fake, if they've done more, set back the course of people who believe in UFOs than anything else, and make it look such a joke.
Well, certainly the body didn't appear like anything anybody has described at MIT.
Exactly. It just does not look like anything from our research, nor from the Roswell research itself.
Yeah, no one really takes it very seriously. Let's go to Fred in Madison. Hi, Fred.
Something's happening out there, and I don't know what it is. Government documents that have been released to me and other Freedom of Information Act researchers show that, contrary to public assertions, that the subject of UFOs is held at the highest level of security. And it's very suspicious to me that very few documents on the subject of abduction have been released. What should our public policy be on this? Who should we report to? In World War II, 50 years ago, if we saw an unusual aircraft in the sky, it was very clear. We would know exactly who to go to, who to report it to, and what would be done. Who do we now report sophisticated aerospace craft violating our airspace to?
Is this sort of a rhetorical question?
Well,
I guess it would be.
Okay, well, abduction, like the rest of the UFO phenomena, has very important legal and public policy issues that we ignore in favor of tabloid-style talk. And I'd like to do a short follow-up after a comment.
We'll see. Okay, we have just a minute or two. CDB?
Well, I was going to comment that simply if I were the Secretary of the Air Force and I couldn't do anything more about defending our airspace than we're doing now, that I think the government policy is going to have to continue to defend that it's happening, to deny that it's happening.
A follow-up, Fred?
Yeah, earlier it was said that there had been no traces of abductions, and I think that they ought to look into some radiation studies because there are some very good close encounter of the third kind cases that involve strong radiation that caused injury or even death to the human people who were there.
All right, Fred, thanks for calling. Let me ask you, John Carpenter, about the people who claim to be abducted. Are they really... They come to you in very painful, are they in a painful situation that they have thought about this for years and years and years, and then suddenly something happens that they now have to see a therapist?
Well, I think, again, it's a reporting phenomenon. Many of the people I've seen, it happened to them 10, 15, 20, even 40 years ago, but they didn't know who to tell. And so, like many strange things that happen to people in their lives, they just kind of sit on it and always puzzle over it. Now that they understand, make a connection that maybe they're missing hours of time and they're seeing the strange light in the sky might be related, or their nightmares now make more sense, they start to explore it and they have a better idea of who to explore it with professionally and sensibly.
That all this talk we've had about there being no hard evidence, we've got to consider that the abductees are evidence. And John Carpenter at MIT, I think, told the best story of a double abduction in which two women crossing Kansas, and get John to talk about it. I mean, this to me was a thrilling story.
Well, John, you want to tell it to us?
Well, yeah, it's a long story, but in short, two women who knew very little to nothing about UFO research could care less. We're coming back from a workshop in Colorado, traveling late at night, having a good time, and... Luckily, they documented every step of the way what they were doing, and they had an hour left to go, and they saw a strange light in the sky before they got to their motel. Well, they pulled over to get a better look, and they were all excited, heart pounding, thrilled that they had seen something very unusual. And then it was 100 feet from their car, shining down beams of light to the ground, and again, they're very excited, but the next thing they know, they're pulling out on the road and traveling on. And now they're tired, exhausted, and just don't want to really talk to each other, which is a very strange transition in a few seconds. Well, it turns out that it took them 3 hours to travel the 1 hour on the interstate, and that made no sense to them, and they were having nightmares and insomnia. And so I worked with both of them independently and under hypnosis, with, despite my trick questions and trying to suggest logical answers to them. They both came up independently with unbelievable tales of being floated up to a craft in the sky, going through the procedure of being taken aboard the ship, one being examined and having something put up her nose, and the other one being forced to watch. And what was nice about this is I could compare the two independent stories that came out and find 43 specific details matching between these accounts. It goes well beyond chance, well beyond coincidence, well beyond their knowledge of the subject, and they didn't have any desire to be a part of it to start with.
Of course, skeptics would say, well, you as a hypnotherapist have led the patients on, so of course they came up with the same story.
Well, I'll tell you something. I have deliberately been known for leading my subjects on purpose to see if they can be led, to see if they are suggestible. But I lead them away from abduction data. I try to lead them towards sensible answers. For example, you know, we have learned that they often find themselves in a round room on an exam table. But I will say something like, well, you're in something, you're in some other place now. What do you see in any of the corners of the room that you're in? Which is a normal question. And they look and look, and then they apologize, and they say, well, I'm sorry, I don't see any corners. It appears to be a round room. That's the way I get a lot of information, leading them the wrong way, and they have to correct me with their experience.
Gordy?
Yeah, I watched Bud Hopkins go through very detailed...
Bud is another...
Yes, he's sort of the Amadeus Breeze of the movement. He's the one who's been doing the longest investigation. But I watched him try to lead two of the women I wrote about in the book away. What John Carpenter, what's in the corner of the room? There aren't any corners in the room. What color hair do the beings have? They don't have hair. And they can't get them to break their story, no
That's
matter
right.
how hard they try.
I would like to confirm that. I've seen some of John's transcripts, and in fact, he does this fairly often. I would also like to point out that John is not the only one who has carefully researched these multiple abduction experiences. I think there are probably now about half a dozen of them that have been done. Richard Haynes is making a collection, and
Dave Jacobs, right?
Yeah. Anyway, their point is, this is one of the things that differentiates, in my mind, this phenomenon from some of the other things, like, for instance, near-death experience. You know, you can show tremendous parallels, and we've had several discussions at the conference about social parallels, which basically are other collective or similar social phenomenon, like satanic ritual abuse, that seem to be happening to many people in a very similar way, and yet we can't verify objectively that it's happening. So, for instance, with near-death experiences, they also have some occasionally a transformative aspect, but they have very similar details for what's going on. But in the abduction case, you have to explain something that doesn't happen very much in these other ones, and that is where you have several people who claim to have had experiences together. Sometimes even these people will be researched by independent investigators and then will be introduced, and they will know each other. And it's difficult to account for this sort of thing with conventional explanations.
And, you know, it brings me back to one of my favorite quotes that, Gordy, you have in the foreword of the front leaf of your book, which I always use all the time, which is the famous Sherlock Holmes quote, which is, when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. And
I like that.
It's very famous. It was taken out, reading out of the cover in Arthur Conan Doyle's The Sign of Four. And this seems to be what's happened here, is that, you know, no one has been able to come up with an explanation here that when you take away everything else, it stares you in the face. Yet it flies in the face of everything we know scientifically about how the world works.
John Mack came up with the five basic dimensions of the abduction phenomenon, and all of us, and John Carpenter, Dave Pritchard, you, me, we all started as absolute skeptics about this, and said it can't be true. Dave Pritchard is far more scientifically inclined than I am, and I think is quite a bit more rigorous about it not being true. But John Carpenter was carried into this, as I understand it, by what he has said and what he's written, kicking and screaming, looking for any other possible excuse for what these people are saying.
That's right.
But nothing fits. as well as what the abductees are saying. And you've got the basic dimensions are, they're all saying the same story, basically. The same sequence of events, they describe the beings the same, what happens the same, the medical procedures are the same.
And there are no folkloric type of things, John, or any other kind
of... I'm glad you mentioned that. Because I've been looking into that even more. And what I've found intriguing is all the little stories of fairies and leprechauns and gnomes and sprites and all those little beings that so many countries have legends of. They used to borrow people for hours at a time. They used to walk through walls. They used to materialize out of thin air. When you really read some of the old stories, they're just like what people are reporting now. But they aren't going to call them aliens back then. They didn't have that language. They didn't have that frame of reference.
But it's very interesting. There's another interesting...
I wanted to interject something here. When I mention this to colleagues, I often get the response, well, gee, you don't want to do this unless you know all about... And then the word or phrase changes, but it can be fairies or gnomes or stigmata on the hands of religious believers to explain the scars that people have from it. Or seances. There is indeed a tremendous amount of similar kinds of experience or stories in other cultures in earlier historic times especially. And let's face it, none of that is really adequately explained. It isn't even probably adequately debunked from the point of view of the Psychop people because they weren't around there at the time to really investigate the stories carefully. My shtick has always been, you know, here we have right now before us this phenomenon, the phenomenon of alien abductions. That we also have an old hag phenomenon, which people report very similar, hearing people walk down the hall and jump on their chest while they're asleep, paralyzed at night. I really think these things are interesting, but they're here and now. You know, we cannot go back and administer personality inventory tests to Salem witches or their victims, but we can do this kind of research and other kinds of research on the people who report these phenomena today, and I would like to see more people do that.
And I think also it's important to know that observers tend to see what their time and environment prepare them for.
Just as a matter of point of information, your book is titled The Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind. Mm-hmm. Give me those four kinds of encounters.
Sort of a lightning guide. In the first kind, say you were driving across the country at night, you look up in the sky and you see an object that is flying, that is mechanical, it's not the planet Earth, and you know, it's obviously an unidentified flying object. Second kind, it may come close enough that you have some sort of electrical malfunction, your car stops, the headlights go out. Third kind, it is close enough either because it's landed or it's nearby that you see it, it's occupied. And in the fourth kind, the occupants make contact with you. They take you from your terrestrial surroundings, whether it's your car or your bedroom, and do unspeakable things.
And very interesting phenomenon or occurrence happened that you mentioned in your book, and we were talking about this before, at the turn of the century. And it seems the technology of the spacecraft matches just one step ahead of the technology of that part of the century.
That's right. And in 1895, what we had said was they were seeing mystery airships, and it would be another 10 years before an airship was capable of, you know, doing a round-trip 7-mile course. But in this case, people all over the country, primarily California in the West and then here in New York, were seeing airships with gondolas.
Like Zeppelins.
Yes.
And so that would be high-tech for that time.
Yes.
Whereas a flying saucer is high-tech for where we are living now.
Yeah, and a flaming chariot would have been high-tech for Ezekiel.
And how do you explain it? Why would that... You mean, is there some clue there to what's going on?
Pass
on that. So John Carpenter, any psychological explanations here, or why would aliens choose to just stay one step ahead?
Well, that's for them to answer. I don't think we can speak for them.
All right. Let's go to the phones to Scott in Palo Alto. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I think you covered the area about parallels to false memory syndrome, and how the virtual reality in the mind can be made to seem as real life. My questions initially for your guest comments were, what has blurred the distinction between the virtual reality of the mind and the perceived reality in life, and two, is regarding little gray men, isn't the interpretation of the unknown, quote-unquote, other, a strip of human attributes, isn't that the result of gray man? I bet he has arms and legs, but he just has no features or nothing identifiably human.
John Carpenter?
Yes. Several comments real quick. First of all, the encounters themselves have correlating evidence. We have many, many cases, over 2,000 documented with landing traces on the ground. The ground has been dehydrated, nothing grows for years, radiation. We have people with grass and mud in their bed, and they don't know how it got there. It's not on their floor, but it's appearing under their sheets on their feet, as if they've been somewhere. There's lots of things that take it well beyond simply something psychological or fantasy. If it were just psychological, you wouldn't have these things tracked on radar, you wouldn't have the landing traces, you wouldn't have photos, you wouldn't have good videos, et cetera, et cetera. That's what's compelling to me, that it's beyond just something like a false memory or of that nature.
Well, why didn't somebody bring back a souvenir from the station? Or, you know, pick up an ashtray or something like that?
Well, several people have tried, and they usually get caught before they leave. They have tried at times. But usually there's not much to pick up.
That's one of the remarkable things, is that they described the spaceship as being empty. There are no pictures from home. There's no decoration of any kind.
No bathrooms either.
Or a kitchen, right.
I wanted to just say one thing about the false memory aspect, and that is that in the false memory syndrome, you report something that you and your investigator are reasonably familiar with what you're supposed to report, namely
right.
child abuse by your uncle or whatever. There have been a couple of studies done. The two that really come to mind are Bullard's study in 1987, which is called On Stolen Time, and then there's a longer version of it. And I think John Miller's paper at the conference, in the Bullard paper, he collected a lot of the stories, and he found what to him, and he's a folklorist. He just looked at them from the point of view of folklore without any regard to whether these stories are true or not. He said these stories are unlike normal human tradition in that there are elements of the story that there's no causal reason why A has to come before B, but in fact it does. And it's particular that the table exam comes before the tour of the ship or the conference. He said in folkloric stories there's no reason, and in stories, if you go back and read stories of fairies, you will not see this kind of consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And he found that the people did not report the entrance to the craft. You know, it would be as if in The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy and her companions were going down the yellow brick road, and suddenly they were in audience with Oz. And you miss all the part about Emerald City and the spires and all that stuff. It just doesn't make a good story. It isn't like human oral tradition. And the point is that the patterns that he found, nobody, not the individuals expressing these things, not the investigators, knew that this was the pattern they were supposed to report or that they were supposed to lead their investigatees into prior to the appearance of his study, and yet what he studied was earlier reports.
How does one, and I'm not saying you in particular, I'm talking about myself and other people who are fascinated by this, how does one say, I'd love to study more of this, but how do I reconcile it with breaking all the laws of physics I've known about space travel and time and space and things like that?
Well, I struggle with this. First of all, I don't think it's surprising if, and I'm not saying these things are easy, I mean, I do not have any beliefs on this issue. The only belief that I have is that it's rather strange and interesting that these people are reporting all these stories, and I'd like to try to get to the bottom of it. But it certainly isn't impossible that extraterrestrial civilizations can send small things to other planets, which then can manufacture bigger things. I think it can be, if you have really good technology, it's easy to send something here. And perhaps the best scientist who made this comment along these lines was Enrico Fermi. When he was told about the possibility of extraterrestrial civilization, he thought a minute and he said, well, why aren't they here? And what he meant was these other civilizations may well have a 1 or 2 billion year lead on us, so that even if they sent out stuff at the speed of chemical rockets, it would have time to get from some other part of the Milky Way to here. So you can explain that they're here. I can't explain how they walk through walls. I mean, that just seems totally impossible to me. And it does contradict what I think of as the law of physics.
Let me ask you, John Carpenter, as someone who is a therapist and works with lots of people, do you suspect that there are other therapists, they could be social workers, they could be psychiatrists, anybody, are encountering more cases of people who claim to have be abducted but don't recognize it as an abduction, or as, or at least people feeling that way?
Yes, I have a wonderful example real quick. A psychologist called me from Virginia in the middle of the day, in between sessions, saying, "My God, I read that pamphlet by the Roper Organization, and this case I've been working with fits it exactly. Because I've been trying to give this lady a diagnosis of multiple personality, but it doesn't fit. She doesn't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on, but I read the pamphlet. It fits like a glove. He says, now I know what's going on with her." Now, that's a good example of neither party having any desire or expectation that this is UFO-related, and yet they had a classic case point. And luckily, he made the connection and called.
So then what do you tell the therapist to do?
I tell him I had too much to say over the phone. I sent him a bunch of papers and helpful suggestions.
There is a little chapter in Alien Discussions about what kind of therapy has been used and what the reaction of the abductees to it is.
And before we go, Dave Pritchard, what kind of physical evidence, I only have about 10 seconds left here, would make scientists more believing?
Well, I don't want to answer that. I think people should go out and do research. I think we found that these people are psychologically normal. We should look at the abductees to see if they have, to really understand whether they have cataracts from the ultraviolet, look at the scars, really catalog that. Are they abuse marks, or are they something new? General overview, we haven't looked at the physical state of the experiencers. I think we should go find, we know that this thing has a tremendous hidden incidence in the general population. We should find out how big it really is and whether those people have the same experience that's been cataloged. I think there's work to be done, physical monitoring, not only of the abductees like electro and cardiograms and brain scans, but you can put a TV up and try to get the picture of the UFO taking someone out of his house. I don't know, but I don't think we're going to solve this problem in one slot.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank my guest. John Carpenter is a psychiatric therapist and clinical social worker in Springfield, Missouri. Dave Pritchard is a scientist at MIT and co-chair of the 1992 Alien Study Conference at MIT. And P.B.D. Bryan is a journalist and author of Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, published by Knopf. Thank you all for joining me today.
Thank you.
Okay.